Ladies and gentlemen, this is Fulton Lewis, Jr., speaking from the studios of WFIL in Philadelphia, where I've been trying to get a fill-in for you today as to what the political trends are in this very important section of a very, very important presidential state. Pennsylvania has 36 of the 531 electoral votes in the presidential election. And that's a very large stake when you consider that only 266 electoral votes are needed to win. As you probably know, Pennsylvania hinges on two great centers of population. One is Pittsburgh in the western part of the state, and the other is the city of Philadelphia and the territory surrounding it. It is always up to the Democrats to build up enough of a lead in these two industrial sections to overcome the normal lead which the Republicans build up in the smaller towns and cities and in the farm areas. Up until 1934, you know, Pennsylvania was consistently Republican. It had one of the most famous political machines of all time, the Republican political machine here in Philadelphia and throughout the state. But the Democrats carried it that year, and they carried it again in 1936. It swung back to the Republican side in 1938, and now in 1940, it becomes one of the really big prizes of the campaign, particularly for President Roosevelt. I say particularly for the president because if he can carry Pennsylvania, it just about seals the victory for him because Mr. Wilkie has very little chance of being elected without Pennsylvania. On the other hand, if the president does not carry the state, it does not necessarily mean his defeat. He could still win by carrying New York and almost any of the other larger states. So Pennsylvania, second on the list of electoral votes for any state, is a real prize for the Democrats if they can get it, and it's not a disastrous loss if they do not get it. Now, as for the Pittsburgh area, I gave you a report last week about the president's visit there and the reception he got as compared with Mr. Wendell Wilkie 10 days before. According to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, it was just about an even break on that visit to Pittsburgh by the two gentlemen. But the fact is that receptions, it so happens, are not counted in November election returns. So those results in Pittsburgh may not mean too much when Election Day comes. It may be that the president still holds much more of a lead in the Pittsburgh area than the turnout of those crowds on that day would indicate. So far, there seems to be no reliable poll in Pittsburgh to indicate how that section really is going in the vote. But for whatever the turnout of crowds does mean, there seems to be no question at all about the comparison here in Philadelphia between the visit of Mr. Roosevelt about a month ago and that of Mr. Wilkie about 10 days ago. All of the accounts here on all sides seem to agree that the president had a clear and very definite edge on the crowds and also on the enthusiasm of the crowd. In the white-collar sections of Philadelphia, Mr. Wilkie did get quite a hand, and in the financial section, he got a real ovation. But in the poorer sections of the town, Mr. Wilkie got little more than a polite and curious audience. Those, of course, are the sections that gave the president a tremendous ovation when he came to Philadelphia a month ago. Incidentally, the Republican leaders who arranged Mr. Wilkie's visit here seem to have made very much the same tactical blunder that the Democratic leaders of Pittsburgh made in the advance arrangement for the president's visit there. You remember that the Democratic officials announced in Pittsburgh in advance of the president's arrival that they expected a crowd of 100,000 people to attend the cornerstone ceremonies for the housing project in Pittsburgh at which the president made his address, which is broadcast by radio. The estimates of those who actually arrived and appeared for that ceremony were somewhere between 10 and 30,000 people instead of 100,000. Well, it seems that here in Philadelphia, the Republican leaders rented Scheib Park, the baseball park, for Mr. Wilkie's speech. They predicted an attendance of 60,000. In fact, they guaranteed that. And somewhere between 10 and 20,000 people actually attended. It seemed that the baseball park was considerably too far out of the center of things. If they had selected the convention hall instead, according to a great many people here, they could have had an overflow meeting and one that was much more impressive. Now, here in Philadelphia, there have been some polls, and they are rather interesting. They've been taken by the Philadelphia Public Ledger. At least one of them has been taken. The newspaper, which, by the way, is supporting Wilkie editorially, not Mr. Roosevelt. And they are handled by that newspaper on a door-to-door basis. While the Republican registration in the city is much heavier, about 6-5 over the Democratic registration, these polls give Mr. Roosevelt a very definite edge over Mr. Wilkie inside the city. Specifically, the Ledger poll gives Mr. Roosevelt 61% of the vote in Philadelphia against 39% for Mr. Wilkie. And the Ledger itself, as of the present time, concedes the city to Mr. Roosevelt by 67,000 votes. The Democratic leaders here, including Mr. John B. Kelly, who I believe was a former mayor, though I'm not sure about that, claim that Mr. Roosevelt will carry the city by 100,000 votes. Both of those figures are considerably under Mr. Roosevelt's majority in Philadelphia in 1936, because in that year he got a majority of 210,000, although he carried the state by about 700,000. Now, among other people, I talked to the political writer this afternoon for the Philadelphia Record. That is a very violently pro-New Deal, pro-Roosevelt newspaper. And he told me that if the 67,000 estimate is correct, it doubtless means that the state balance will be very, very close in November, unless Pittsburgh turns in a huge majority for the president. He seems to think that the 100,000 majority here is not going to be any too comfortable a majority, but his estimate was that when the votes actually are in, Philadelphia probably will turn in better than 100,000 majority for the president. He does not base that on any polls of his own, merely his own observations. Right around Philadelphia here, there's a ring of counties that are solidly Republican, wealthy sections, most of them, and he said that those counties probably would almost wipe out the 67,000 lead if it doesn't go above that. So it does appear that this state of Pennsylvania is very, very much in doubt. It is still wide open fighting ground and anybody's prize. Now, in the meantime, there's one rather important angle of the campaign that has not been touched on so far, but it is threatening to become a major item or a major consideration. It has to do with the Negro vote, which is, as you know, very important. It can be a deciding factor in some of the states, New York, here in Pennsylvania, Illinois, Indiana, Massachusetts, and West Virginia particularly, also New Jersey. The Negro vote in those states represents about 5% of the total, a little more in some states, particularly in Maryland. And while it used to be Republican, of course, it went very heavily Democratic in 1936, and it remained that way in 1938. There's a very important current development in that connection, which has to do with the draft situation. It seems that the Negro leaders are very much incensed because of the War Department's policy in regard to drafting of Negroes under the present draft program. These leaders claim that the Army is following a policy of segregation in the training of Negroes who are called in the draft, and they charge that the president himself has approved that program of segregation. Several leading Negro newspapers here and in other states as well have carried scorching editorials for several days now, criticizing what they call an affront by the White House. In the meantime, they are claiming Mr. Wilkie's statement in Chicago recently that he opposes any Jim Crow policies by the federal government, and so this entire block of votes seems to be much up in the air at the present time. It so happens, however, that before this new development took place, I contacted several of the leading Negro political leaders, or non-political leaders, rather, leaders who are well-versed and well-familiar with politics, but who do not take part in it themselves, to try to get for you their estimates of how their vote was likely, and they may change from day to day because of future developments. For what they're worth, here they are, and it may be that this little matter will be patched up. Anyway, here is the division of the Negro vote according to states as their own nonpartisan leaders estimate it at this time. They say that Massachusetts and West Virginia will be 50-50 between Mr. Wilkie and the president. Massachusetts and West Virginia, 50-50. In New York, the president, they say, will get 60-65% of the Negro vote. In Illinois, 65%. In Ohio and in Pennsylvania, only 40%. In Michigan and Missouri, 55-60%. In Indiana, Mr. Roosevelt, they say, will get 45 to 50%. In New Jersey, they say he'll get about 55%, and in California, about 70%. But that's enough of politics. Today, as you know quite well, has been registration day for the first peacetime draft in the entire history of the United States. It started with a radio greeting by President Roosevelt himself at 8 a.m. this morning, in which he explained that this is the democratic method, the democratic way for a nation to safeguard its own future liberties. He hopes that these men will never be needed on the firing line, these men who were drafted today. He said that the surest way to avoid the necessity of putting them on the firing line is to be so well prepared that no one will ever dare to risk an attack on us. There were about 16.5 million young men registered today throughout the nation, every male in the United States between the ages of 21 and 35 inclusive, except those who already are in some branch of the active defense service of the country. And out of that number, some 800,000 are to be called for active service of 12 months between now and next April. That means, if you stop to figure it out, that the chances of anyone being called for actual draft service are about 1 in 20, generally speaking. But, of course, there are definite provisions and policies by which married men without dependents and men who have dependents and who are unmarried, men with business ties are to be deferred. And even so, even if you happen to be unmarried and without dependents and registered today, the chances of your being among those who are called are only about 1 in 4. Because more than 3 million of the young men who registered today are in that category of eligibles to be called immediately, and the Army only wants 800,000 of them. As you doubtless know, everyone between the age limits had to register today, but some of them, people who are mentally deficient, or blind, or crippled, their names are eliminated from the list at once, automatically. All that was asked on this card today was the name, address, color of eyes and hair and so forth, employer's name, the name of someone who will always know where to locate the individual. The next step is to redistribute those registration cards back to the home of Mr. John Jones, wherever he may come from, if he was an absentee. And Mr. Jones will be mailed a questionnaire within the next few days asking further details about his family, his connections, his job. And on the basis of those questionnaires, the local draft board will eliminate a lot of the cards for automatic exemptions and deferments of one kind or another. And finally, the cards will be numbered just at random, 1, 2, 3, and so on. Each individual will get a number. Finally, when all that's done, all of these eligible red drafts will draw numbers out of a bowl, and in the order in which he draws those numbers, the various people with those numbers in the local communities will be called to their local draft boards for final examination. But that's the top of the news as it looks from here, ladies and gentlemen. Until tomorrow evening from Washington, good night.
You have been listening to Fulton Lewis, Jr., Mutual's nightly news reporter on the national scene, who comes to you each evening, Monday through Friday, at the same time. Tonight, Mr. Lewis spoke from the studios of WFIL in Philadelphia. The Mutual Broadcasting System.